got that nice bracelet thing going again. I'm there with you.
Okay, Tony. Okay.
I went with Tony here for lunch.
Yeah. Are you sure? Yeah. Okay. This is Tuesday, February 4th. On the agenda day, we have three bills brought to us by the Secretary of State's Election Division. First, we'll have a public hearing on Senate Bill 132, which increases the maximum penalty for each violation of election laws. Jim, would you like to go over the bill with us, please?
Pretty simple bill. It increases the maximum civil penalty for violation of election laws from $250 to $1,000.
Okay. So do we have anyone signed up to testify on this bill?
We have Mr. Levin back.
John. Is it Lindbach?
Lindbach.
Okay. Just like it's spelled. Okay. You would put your name on the record for us. And
for the record, my name is John Lindbach. I am director of the Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office. We're proposing Senate Bill 132 because we believe that the maximum of $250 penalty for first-time violations in some cases of our election laws is not serving as a deterrent. And I'll give you a prominent example. We had an example of a school district where employees of the school district, including the superintendent, were found, well, the superintendent was found in violation of our laws regarding what public employees can do on public time concerning campaigning regarding a measure on the ballot. The employee admitted wrongdoing, was found in violation of the law, assessed the maximum penalty of $250, and was quoted in the paper and announced in our office when he came in to pay the fee that was the best investment of $250 he'd ever made. It was obviously an example where the amount of the penalty that we're able to assess obviously was not a deterrent in that particular case. In some other cases, it may be. But the way that our penalty system is established is we have minimums and maximums, and we're given some flexibility within that range of what to assess as a penalty. And for first-time violations, we generally go the minimum route, but for egregious violations, we will try to go to the maximum route. But the problem here is that the maximum for the most egregious violation simply is not enough in our view. And so we are asking that, asking for this bill, which would increase the civil penalty maximum from $250 to $1,000 for violations of election laws or rules for which no penalty is otherwise provided. And that's a quick summary.
Okay, thank you, John. Questions of the committee?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, was in the case of the person who said it was the best money he'd ever spent, was that person a first-time offender?
Yes.
And you fined him the max? And why did you fine him the max?
Because they were very brazen in violating the law.
And what was the nature of the violation?
Using,
Madam Chair, if you don't mind.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Campaigning on public time. Public resources.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I'm trying to look up the sections of law because the witness has not spoken at all to removing subsection 2 of section 1, which is the maximum penalties for violations of 251.049 or 251.405. I'm kind of curious to know what those are, and it's a different chapter of the law. I just now got to it, so I apologize for not doing it beforehand, but some speak to that part of it.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood your question. Senator Beyer, can you...
Madam Chair, in addition to increasing the civil penalty from $250 to $500, on lines 10 and 11 on page 1 of the bill, you are deleting from statute the civil penalty not to exceed $1,000 for each violation of these ORS numbers. And I'm wondering what those are.
I'm sorry, I don't have my statute book with me. I'll have to look those up for you. I can't answer that here at the table.
Do you have an answer to that?
Well, 251.049 is submitting a false signature under subsection 2 of the section, so now I've got to go back up to subsection 2 of the section.
We'll just stand at ease while we look at these.
Okay.
That's the only one.
Okay.
I guess you could just ask the question in general, why the deletion?
Well, that's kind of my question. This bill is more than just what's described. That's why I was wondering what else it does.
Go ahead, John, if you want to respond.
I'm sorry. I have to beg your indulgence. Senator Beyer, I have to look at that to refresh my memory on that because I can't remember, so I'd have to look.
Would you like the book?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't have the statutes in front of me, but the general section that applies to is under chapters 246 to 260, so it would include that specific provision under section 1, subsection 1. Is that not correct? It currently is a civil penalty. It just... Section 1 statute is inclusive of everything amongst a number of chapters. Is that right?
Yes, and I might suggest the reason it's being... This is Jim Stenberg's committee staff. It says on line 10 not to exceed $1,000, so the penalty limit already is $1,000 for those sections. I think this bill just moves $1,000 maximum for everything.
Yes. So are you saying that a false signature would go from 250 to 1,000? Is that what you're reading?
No, it is 1,000, Matt.
It is 1,000.
It is 1,000.
So false signature was one of them. Have you found the other one, Senator?
So it's a Scribner's correction.
Yeah, Madam Chair, they are both false signatures. One is the voter template, both voter template, one dealing with the county clerks.
Current law is each violation not to exceed $1,000. I think that probably means each signature, each false signature.
That's to both read for each violation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just think it's redundant to specifically mention in those subsections when in section 1 it also says 1,000 for each violation. So you don't need to have the special reference for bringing some other fines up to parity with the false signatures.
I hate it when members read bills. It just slows the process down.
We're just notorious for that.
Okay. Senator Beyer, do you have any other comments or questions?
No other questions right now.
Pardon me? No other questions. Any other committee members? Okay, if not, thank you, John. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 132. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 139, which establishes elections operating account. Jim, do you want to speak to that measure?
Yes, this establishes an elections operating account within the Office of Secretary of State. It also doubles the fees for space in the voter's pamphlet.
And, John, you're going to speak to this bill as well. I have some other folks who'd like to speak to this bill, too.
Yes. I'd like to respectfully... We appreciate the committee scheduling this bill quickly. We would like to respectfully request that you not move this bill today. We are evaluating the situation with the voter's pamphlet and our budget. And we want to reevaluate this bill for possible changes and bring amendments to you, but we're not yet ready to do that. The bill, as currently fashioned, would establish an elections operating account in the general fund, and fees and penalties collected by the Secretary of State's office for the voter's pamphlet, for C&E violations, for any other kind of violation would be credited to that account. We are currently the only program agency within the Secretary of State's office that is does where the fees and the penalties collected do not go back into our and become part of our budget. They go into the general fund. And we would like to be treated in like fashion with other agencies in the Secretary of State. But it also, I think the part of this bill that's likely to generate more debate from the public will be the doubling of fees that's proposed in this bill. In light of the budget situation, we want to reevaluate that because it's clear that doubling the fees would not accomplish or solve our budget problem that is projected for next year. And we'd like to look at that in more detail and come back to you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, we also have a Steve Lanning.
I guess I do have a question, Madam Chair. So, I mean, I would guess since you do the voter's pamphlet on, you know, newsprint, you're probably doing it, one would assume, on the cheap. I mean, as cheaply as you can. Is there any way to size it down to save money?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, we have looked at various options in the past biennium and talked about those options during past special sessions in which to make adjustments on size, on going to one argument pro and one argument con, to cutting down how many words that people are allowed to submit in a measure argument.
Some really ugly legislative pictures in there that you could get rid of.
Yeah, yeah. And some nice ones, too. But
present company accepted. fine. Except for Senator Beyer.
But that's part of the conversation that we want to have. Is we want to look at all the options and discuss the options with the legislature, and we want to collect good information for you on that. And we just believe we're not quite ready.
Well, I think it's the most important document in an election. I mean, and I don't say that because I like it. I mean, that's what I get from constituents all the time. Senator Brown's been using the same picture since like the 70s.
Well, that's the case. That's
against the law.
Well, I wasn't going to report it until you got it up to $1,000.
Yeah.
John, do you think by doubling the fee, how many pages do you think then the voter's pamphlet would be? Would it be? What do you expect?
Well, that's always a good question. The voter's pamphlet is exceedingly difficult to item to budget for because although the number of candidates is consistent, relatively consistent from one biennium to the next, what is not consistent is the number of measures that make the ballot, how controversial they are, how many arguments are filed for and against those measures, and we have no way to anticipate that. So what the legislature has historically done is budget for the voter's pamphlet based on what happened in the past biennium, and then they tell us if your costs are going to exceed that, go to the e-board and request additional funds. We did not have to do that this biennium. In past bienniums, the Secretary of State's office has indeed had to do that, go back and request additional funds. So as far as I'm not sure what the question was. Was it a per-page cost? Was that your question?
No. Do you expect if you increase, you have a smaller voter's pamphlet statement? Do you think you're going to have a bigger one? What do you think?
Well, if we increase, it could be a combination of things. One of the options could be to increase fees and make other adjustments to the voter's pamphlet to cut costs, such as going from 300 words to a word limit of less than that for a measure argument that would allow us to print more arguments on a page and thus save costs. So it could be a combination of all of those things, and that's why we'd like to look at all these various options and come back to you with what we think is a reasonable proposal and that tries to save this thing, because it's a huge item in the budget and the reduction targeted for our agency is large.
Senator Brown.
John, I don't know if you can kind of give me this estimate, but the current fees, the $600 and $300, does that subsidize, and the $500, does that subsidize a third, a half of the voter's pamphlet statement?
The general rule is that fees pay for about one quarter of the voter pamphlet. The general fund subsidizes three quarters of the cost. Our cost for the 2002 general election for the voter pamphlet was $429,870 for production, $324,000 and $324,271 for postage, which roughly gives you $750,000 in change for costs. Fees paid $227,000 of that. And I have some voters pamphlet statistics here that outline costs. I'd be glad to hand those out today so you can look at those. It shows that kind of breakdown going back to 1994.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Steve, you want to come on up, please?
Chair, can I ask one last question?
Okay, John, we have one last question if you'll share the...
I'm just curious whether a voter's pamphlet is mailed to every voter, or whether you consolidate with where you have several voters in a household.
They're sent out one per household in Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, John. I think that's fine. Steve, welcome. You'll state your name for the record, please.
Yeah. Chair Clarnell, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we just want to briefly weigh in on this bill. We don't support it the way that it is because it does double the cost in the voter pamphlet statement. And one of the things that we do in all of our polling, no matter what we're polling on, we always ask voters in our polls, what do they use for information? And the number one thing that they always say to us in our polls over the years was that they rely on the voter's pamphlet as their number one source for information, especially on ballot measures. And we just feel that by doubling it, at this point, there's going to be a lot of small organizations and concerned individuals that won't be able to have a statement in the voter's pamphlet, and voters will get less information. We don't have any problem with any kind of a modest increase, whether it be 10, 20%, whatever. That's fine. But by doubling it, it will have an impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Any questions? Okay, thank you for coming. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 140. Jim, do you want to talk to us about this bill?
Yes, Senator Clarnell. Senate Bill 140 removes the requirement that the prevailing party in a contested election be awarded costs and attorney's fees. It gives discretion to courts to allocate costs and attorney's fees in those cases.
Okay, John, do you want to come up and visit with us about why the Secretary of State would like this bill, please, Senate Bill 140?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 140 is the result of an actual situation that we have that cropped up in Eugene this year. We had a case where there was clear error by the filing officer for the city of Eugene in the handling of petitions, candidate petitions. She didn't do it correctly. we found her in violation of the law. And fined her $250. And the person who complained about that case wanted to file a contest of election. And it was my view that the person had potentially a pretty good case. For those of you who are unfamiliar with contest of elections, those occur after the election is over. And the results are in and are less disruptive to the election process than somebody filing a lawsuit in advance of the election and trying to stop the whole thing. This particular person was intimidated out of filing the contest of election because he would have had to have paid the attorney's fees of all the other parties involved in the suit if he lost, even though he had a pretty good case, in my view. But he was intimidated out of doing that and instead went the route of filing a lawsuit in advance of the election because the situation was not the same there. The judge is able to apportion the costs or fees out after the decision is in based on what the judge believes is fair. We have an interest in the smooth running of elections and think that in that particular case it would have been less disruptive to the situation to have the person file a contest after the election was over. But this situation clearly intimidated this person, and as I understand it, others in the past in Oregon have found this to be intimidating when they consider filing a contest of an election. So this bill proposes that we treat contest of elections like other litigation in which the judge can decide how to fairly apportion the fees and remove that provision that seems to be intimidating to people.
How many of these types of things do you have?
They're very rare, like maybe one a biennium, if that.
And explain to me again the filing errors.
Oh, it had to do with the nominating petitions, and if you run for city office or county office in Oregon, you're supposed to submit your nominating petitions to the filing officer and have them approve them first. This particular filing officer handled different candidates in different ways, it was a clear violation of the law, and sort of there was lots of publicity around it, and it sort of generated a hoopla down there, and created this desire to file suit and try to deal with it in that way.
And you're saying someone did file suit and dealt.
He did file suit and try to stop the election. He was not successful, but he did try, and it would have been very disruptive to all the other candidates on the ballot, all the other races, all the other items.
Questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Well, you say he did not win the suit, so in fact his own attorney's advice would probably sound he would have lost afterwards and would have been subject to attorney's fees?
If he had lost afterwards, he would have been subject to pay the attorney's fees of the other parties, yes.
So, I guess, just a clarification, did he lose on the same grounds beforehand? They would have lost, so he probably would have seen afterwards also.
Well, the circumstances behind which judges make these decisions, I don't want to assume that, because sometimes timing is very important. Sometimes a judge doesn't want to stop an election, and would make the decision on that basis that they'd rather err, if they're going to err, rather err on the side of not stopping an election than stopping one. It's our feeling that these matters are better resolved at the end of the process than in the middle and in the heat of an election.
So if I understand correctly, I'm just trying to help here, just make sure I understand. Is it the what the gentleman was doing was would have stopped all the elections?
He was trying to get people tossed off the ballot, stop the election, trying to do anything he could, arguing that the filing officer should be required to go back and do things over.
So that would have affected the whole election?
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't want to run the risk of paying attorney's fees if he lost in a full election contest. That's my guess.
Yeah, okay.
Senator Corcoran, go ahead, please.
So I'm a little unclear. In this particular case, you thought the guy had a case.
I did. It was a good case.
But he didn't. He made a case to the mm-hmm. judge before the mm-hmm. fact.
Mm-hmm.
But he also would have had the opportunity to come in front of another judge after the fact?
Well, yeah, you could. You had two options. If you think a filing officer hasn't done their job prior to an election, you can sue him. Or you can wait until after the election and file a contest of election.
And the contest of election, Madam Chair, that would basically just throw in a new election. It would create a new election if the person prevailed.
It can if the judge decides that's what's warranted. They could ask to go back and do the election over again. Generally, that's what people ask for.
So, but the judge could, as another means of settling it, allow the candidate that wasn't elected to hold the position?
Oh, that would be pretty rare, I think.
Okay, so most of the time what they do is order another election.
Correct.
So I'm trying to figure, I kind of like loser pay. I like it in, it controls the amount of arbitrations we have in labor disputes, for instance, because, you know, the employer always has more money than the union, so if it's a equal pay, then there's not as much of an incentive not to go to arbitration in cases. But I'm also concerned that the ramification of this could be that an innocent party who has a claim made against him or her and then prevails might have to pay part of a nuisance court cost. It just occurs to me that could be the outcome. That if you give the discretion to the judge and the judge says a pox on both of you guys, you're both jerks, you both pay half the settlement, even though the judge decides in favor of the person, not the plaintiff, but the, mm-hmm. the other party.
Well, I can't say that couldn't happen, but you know, the presumption in our bill that judges make fair decisions on fees. Now, if you don't trust the judges to make fair decisions on fees, I mean that you're the policymakers here, and then you don't want this bill.
Well, ma'am,
because we make the presumption that the judges will apportion the fees out fairly after the litigation is over.
Madam Chair, just one more question, John. What do you think? I mean, reasonably speaking. A lawyer probably wouldn't take this on a contingency basis, so they charge $100 and a quarter, $150 an hour. How long would all this take?
A contest of election. Usually, from what I've seen, I mean, Bush v. Gore was a contest of election. Usually, for a controversial contest of election, they can't get settled fast enough because there's usually an issue about who has the right to hold that office,
mm-hmm.
and people want to get that resolved.
So it could be spending.
Could be spending, and it could be, but usually they're not protracted.
Well, let me ask
the courts you, understand that.
Let me ask the question differently then, because I don't want to revisit Gore Bush. In the state of Oregon, when was the last time there was a contest of election?
I believe our last contest of election was a fellow out in Eastern Oregon who got left off the ballot. He had in a primary election, a Democratic.
Is he wearing a flag on his tie?
No.
Okay.
It was a Democratic primary election. His district crossed county lines. one of the counties accidentally left him off the ballot. He filed a contest of election. He lost. The judge said there weren't enough Democratic votes in that county. He was a Democratic candidate. There weren't enough votes in that county where if you'd been on the ballot, you could have won. Okay. I mean, that was the decision of the judge. And it was resolved fairly quickly. We did change some of the contest of election statutes in the last session, regular session. For example, so that when a person has a contest of election in a place like, I think this was Morrow County, they can file the suit out in their county. They don't have to come to Salem. And we made other kinds of changes to improve that process and make it more understandable to people. But as so much of election law is passed and adopted because of what happened in the last election, and that's a very common thing. This is another example of that. It just looked fundamentally, that situation looked fundamentally unfair to me, that this person who had a reasonable case, and he did lose, but he had a reasonable case, was intimidated out of filing a contest of election because of this provision in law. And it just doesn't seem fair to me that this should be treated differently from a lot of other litigation.
Thank you. Good answer.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. You said that he lost, but I don't understand. I thought you said he was intimidated out of.
Well, he did file suit, but he filed suit before the election rather than waiting to file a contest of election after the election was over.
But isn't that a higher bar? I mean, I think you indicated that before. That's a much higher bar for a judge to call off a whole election, correct?
I think it's a very, very high bar in either case, but it's particularly puts the judge in a difficult situation if you're in the heat of an election. People are already campaigning, people are already on the ballots are already on the streets, and somebody's coming into court and standing in front of you and saying, "I want you to call this off."
And why, if I could follow up?
Yes, Senator Burdick, please.
Why would he not have been intimidated suing before the election?
Because this provision on attorney's fees does not apply to those suits filed before the
election.
Right.
Fees. And one final question, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Is overturning the election, if they file after the election, is overturning the election the only remedy available, or are there monetary remedies available as well in the statute?
I'd have to look at that to answer that with real precision. Most people don't ask for monetary damages other than paying their attorney's fees. Because what they really want is a reversal in the outcome of what happened on election day. They usually lost. People who win elections don't file contests. It's just about always the people who are in the losing end.
Thank you.
This just says cost, disbursements, and attorney fees. So. Doesn't say judgment. I don't know if that makes a difference.
Okay, thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Okay, anyone else that wants to testify on any of these bills? Did you not get signed up? Anyone else? Any of these bills? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 140. And
this isn't a very good committee. You know, my general government committee, we take bills and just put them right out. All we're doing is listening to them.
I notice some of those when they come to the floor, too.
Yeah, they get sent back. That's right. Good point. Okay. Fine. I rest my case, and I'm not suing.
Okay, good. Senator Brown just had to go give a speech. And these bills that have all come before us today, hopefully you'll get Senator Brown, who chairs the committee Thursday, if you want to bring any of these back, or for further work sessions, let her know what you think of these bills. Okay? Members of the committee, thank you for your attention. We are adjourned.
You know what? I'll tell you something about that bill that we had to pass. It became hilarious. So I called Tom Rosen and said, "You've got to fix this."
Well,
I do think we've got more scenarios.